There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our podcast that is a roundup of the best bits of today's show from Wednesday, the 26th of February.
This morning we're talking about food.
Feed me, Simo. Feed me all night long. Cause if you feed me, Simo, I can grow up big and strong.
We'll get on to the economics of eating out in 10 or 15 minutes' time. First up, though, the grammar police have been in touch, Thomas.
Oh, no, what have I done now?
No, it's not you, it's me. Restaurateurs, not restauranteurs, someone writes in. This is the person who runs a restaurant. Thank you very much indeed. So I've been looking to find out which is correct and which is not. And it turns out they are both correct. In British English, restaurateur with an N is acceptable. It is, according to the Collins English Dictionary, another word for restaurateur without an N, which is derived from the French and the Latin. Thank you very much indeed.
I've always wondered about that, so I'm glad you've put that one to pay. If there's one thing I took away from 3 weeks in the business breakfast, it is that. It's the question that I would never had enough courage to ask because I didn't want to be seen to be the silly one. You know those sort of words you just take for granted because you just don't want to ask about them. So how many times have you, restaurateur? Doesn't make sense, does it? Because we are brought up with the noun, the restaurant.
Yes.
That's what it's all about. So therefore, it goes without saying that somebody who runs a restaurant would be a restaurateur.
Yes.
And yet, we get all French, don't we?
We do a little bit.
Au cuisine.
Producer Shruti is a fluent French speaker. You've got a degree in French. What's your view?
I don't have a degree in French. I just speak French.
You did a degree in French, didn't you?
I got a certificate.
That's good enough for me. Certificate, we'll take that.
I did an A-level in it. I've lost that certificate, that's for sure.
Let's move on. India. Fluent Hindi speaker, this much I do know about you, producer Shruti.
Yes.
And President Donald Trump has spent 2 days in India. He has now left. His official visit is over. He wrote the book, The Art of the Deal. There haven't been many deals announced, have there?
No, and that's what most of the news agencies around the world have picked up on, that there were no big announcements, there were no signing. And President Trump, in his press conference as well, after as the event was concluding, said that he's not going to make any controversial statements or anything of any sort because he's happy with the relationship that him and Prime Minister Modi have currently, and he thinks this is the best relations US and India have had in a long time.
Well, let's hear from President Trump now. This is him speaking on his visit to India.
But I thought it was a great 2 days. It was a fantastic 2 days. I'm going to be not at all controversial because I don't want to blow the 2 days plus 2 days of travel on one answer. One little answer. Little answer like John will ask me one little simple question and you'll blow it out and that'll be the end of the trip. They won't even talk about the trip. So I'll be very, very conservative in my answers if you don't mind. But we did. We had a great time. We had a great meeting.
Fair enough, to be honest. State from the Henry Kissinger media training playbook, and why not? In terms of deals, India has bought $3 billion worth of helicopters, hasn't it?
Yes.
But there's been no trade deal, and that was the big thing, because President Trump has previously called India the king of tariffs. And he did mention it. He did mention Harley Davidson's again and the import tariffs that India levies on many American goods, but he didn't blow it up out of all proportion, Shruti.
No, and as most of the media has pointed out, it's been more about his photo opportunities. So it's been a showy trip where, you know, because he went to the Taj Mahal, he went to the Sabarmati Ashram. It's been more about the photo opportunities than the tariffs and the trade deals, because as we know, President Trump wants to reduce the trade deficit with India. And in the past, he has said that he wants to work on a trade deal, but he says it will not be now, but it will come later.
Later on this year, he's saying potentially,
yes.
But watch this space. Thomas.
I've got to jump in here if I can about it's just the gift that keeps on giving, Donald Trump. And there we are talking about him negotiating trade deals over in India. Yesterday, we were talking about his diet and that of Warren Buffett and things like that. And then This just pops up in front of me here. So does anyone, do you know about Dr. Ronnie Jackson?
No.
So Dr. Ronnie Jackson is now running to be a Republican congressman. He is Donald Trump's former physician. So obviously had a little bit of an insight. So he's just gone online, on record, talking about the sort of challenges that he faced. And I quote, "The exercise stuff never really took off as much as I wanted it to, but we were working on his diet. We were making the ice cream less accessible to Donald, and we were putting cauliflower into his mashed potatoes." So basically, he's admitting that he was hiding vegetables in a 70-year-old's diet to try and get him to lose weight.
And hiding the ice cream.
And hiding the ice cream. And trying to convince him to exercise more. He said the biggest wall, no pun intended with regards to walls, etc., but the biggest wall that he faced was that Donald Trump's idea of exercise was just standing on a golf course. Apparently that constituted exercise.
Well, you're swinging your arms slightly, aren't you?
Didn't matter. That wasn't. It was just the very fact of being on a golf course. That's exercise.
You've got to get in and out of the golf buggy, haven't you? You know, there's a step there. That's what's been happening in India. Meanwhile, in Saudi Arabia...
Don't call it a comeback!
Khaled Al-Faleh, we thought he was gone after he was fired as energy minister in Saudi Arabia in September, but he is back and back with a vengeance. They've created an entirely new ministry for him. Here's the deal. Overnight, big cabinet reshuffle in Saudi Arabia. Not one, not two, but three new ministries. Investment, which he's running, tourism, and also sport. But it's the investment one that's caught everybody's attention. A surprise choice, perhaps, Khaled Al-Faleh, given that it's less than 6 months since he was removed from the Ministry of Energy. But maybe not such a surprise when you listen to this. This is him speaking a while ago when he was the energy minister. And he's a guy who used to run Aramco as well. So oil in his veins. But this is him talking about the importance of diversification for the Saudi economy. And when you listen to this, perhaps it's no surprise that he's been chosen to head the ministry.
It's not just my tendency, but it's the directive of His Royal Highness, the Crown Prince. Industry is the number one priority for the kingdom. Oil is important. It's going to be important for as long as all of us live and beyond, for generations to come. But the future of this nation, the future of my children and grandchildren and the next few generations of Saudi Arabia are going to be shaped by how we plan and execute programs for implementing Vision 2030, like the NIDLA program we're launching today. And I had to give it a higher priority.
So great news that Khaled Al-Faleh is back, genuinely very well respected within international circles. The slight downside is the man he's replaced.
2019 was a great year for us. We have welcomed more than 1,131 new international...
That's the voice of His Excellency Ibrahim Al-Omar, who until yesterday, in fact this time yesterday, was the governor of the Saudi Arabia General Investment Authority. And last Sunday, that was him speaking on the Business Breakfast when we did the outside broadcast from the Burj Al Arab and the Emerging Markets Intelligence and Research private meeting. Really nice bloke.
We're sorry, Your Excellency.
Good friend of the Business Breakfast. He promised to fly Tom and I out there for some wonderful sporting events.
Wanted us to do a broadcast out there and everything. Put that one up on the shelf for a while then, shall we?
Joking.
He'll be back though, won't he?
He will. He's genuinely a lovely bloke. Good friend of Georgia Tolley's as well. So a lot of love for His Excellency Ibrahim Al-Omar in the Dubai Eye newsroom at the moment, former governor of the Saudi Arabia General Investment Authority. That organisation basically has been taken and upgraded to a ministry. That's kind of what's happened.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Let's talk food, if we can. Why? Dubai Food Festival kicks off round about now. It starts today. It goes all the way through to mid-March. Basically, promises something for everyone, any taste and any wallet. And to that end, we're going to take an insider's look at the business of food and why running a restaurant in Dubai, as big or as small as you like, is more difficult than many out there might think. We're going to talk to the brains behind Maize Tacos, the Mexican restaurant which offers preservative-free street food favourites, including tacos, burritos, rice bowls, and, of course, quesadillas. Started out as a food truck, then, of course, very successful pop-ups, and now bricks and mortar. So let's talk about that and, of course, the industry as a whole with the co-founder of Maize Tacos, Luma McClough, who joins us live in studio. Good to have you on board.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Good morning.
First and foremost, congratulations on, several new things, a new arrival in the household and a new arrival in the business as well.
Yeah, literally a day apart. So it's been quite, the excitement levels are quite high right now.
You've had your hands full, that's for sure. Listen, yeah. Luma, let's get your thoughts on the industry as a whole. Dubai Food Festival has does kick off in earnest today. Where are we at with food and beverage at the moment? As an entrepreneur, as a founder of a very successful food brand here, are we getting to saturation point when it comes to offerings?
I think we're just about there. It seems like we're literally just at the point where there's every day there's a new taco shop and 20 new burger places. But then at the same time, unfortunately, there's 10 new places a week that are closing down. So I don't know. It's interesting. I don't think that there's ever enough. I mean, you're seeing a lot more homegrown concepts popping up, and you're seeing a lot more, you know, owners and the brains behind the brands taking part in it and, you know, working on these cloud kitchens and being the face of the company. So in terms of saturation, it's definitely there, but you're also seeing a lot of different aspects of F&B.
You mentioned the homegrown element. You and your husband have thrown everything into the business. It is a homegrown brand. It's garnered great success. Does that help in terms of the sort of marketing and setting yourself apart from the competition?
Yeah, I mean, if you decide to make it your full-time gig, I think it will definitely help. We consider ourselves a family business, which means that, like, where I grew up in the States, it's totally normal to walk into your local taqueria or your local shawarma place or coffee shop and see, you know, the mom, the uncle, the cousin, the little baby, and you become part of that family. You know that you're going there not just for an amazing meal, but you're going there to feel like you're part of that journey, that brand, that it's very, very inclusive. And I think it definitely helps. I've become very close friends with some of my customers throughout the last 3 years. They come to my house. And it's because every time they're there, they know that they'll be able to have a conversation and chat. And I sit down. And I mean, that's why I do it. I love it. I love getting to know why these people love my food.
Let's talk about the Maize story if we can, because a lot of people will think, okay, they start in restaurants and then, of course, there's pop-ups and then, of course, there's food trucks to expand the brand. You've done it the other way around almost, which is not unlike many others here in recent years. Food trucks, we've seen a huge increase in the number of food trucks available out there. That's how it all started for you a couple of years ago. Then very successful pop-ups and now the bricks and mortar. Why make the decision 5 months ago to have a permanent base?
I think we tested the model long enough. I mean, at that point, it had been 2 years. We wanted to take the plunge. Rent had gone down, and we had identified that JLT was a great place for us after doing so many different pop-ups. The demographic was there. The delivery penetration there was quite high. You had commercial, you had residential at the same time, and you were close to all of these quite populated areas where our demographic resided in. So that's why we chose bricks and mortar. But the reason why we chose that journey is because, quite frankly, it's cheaper, less investment. You don't have to take the plunge all at one time. You needed to identify the fact that, listen, it might not work. It's a formula at the end of the day. So how can you minimize the risk as much as possible? And that's with food trucks or kiosks or pop-ups, which you're seeing now, like 3 years ago. Oh my God, it was like only a food truck. And now you're seeing cloud kitchens and you can go work off of somebody else's license. And oh my God, the game keeps changing every few months. It's crazy.
One thing in the game at the moment is delivery apps. Rich was referencing the KPMG report a little earlier on. They're seeing that as one of the big challenges for the industry. Yeah. I can see on your face there where we're going with apps. Is it a fine line, a balance?
We're exclusive with Deliveroo, so I am pretty much good at negotiation. So I negotiated a really, really great percentage to stay exclusive. But that wasn't only for the favor of a really low commission. It was because The thing about my yeast is we're a preservative-free, fresh concept. We spend a lot of money on our ingredients. So, and tacos are not the coolest thing to be delivered because of the protein and the bread, and it becomes soggy, etc. So we wanted to make sure if we went with one portal, we can control every aspect of that rather than going with three, four different portals, delivery portals. And, you know, let's say, imagine you have four deliveries at one point. That's when you just open up for so many mistakes. So we decided to go with one and to take care of the quality and lower down the rate. And that's what we've been doing. Going exclusive means that the moment I choose to open up the opportunity to myself and go with Uber Eats or Zomato or whatever's out there, my rate with them will literally go up by 10%. So even though I've been loyal to them for 3 years, whatever, I'm automatically losing that big revenue share because I need more revenue to go with the other platforms. So it is tough. It's quite tough, to be honest, to be able to leverage all of those opportunities because it requires a big investment.
Last one from me. Dubai Food Festival kicks off today, encouraging more and more people to try new foods. Is it good for businesses like yours to encourage people to get more involved in the industry?
In terms of like joining
customers coming in.
Yeah, it would be great. I mean, we did food festival events, and for as a new brand, it's amazing because you get to reach, like, some of the events bring very, very high footfall. So you get to reach all of those people looking for new brands and foodies looking for new exciting businesses out there, and you can all reach them at one place. You know, that's why they're going. So yeah, I definitely think food events are great. You just have to choose the right ones.
Choose the right ones. Choose Maize Tacos. Get yourself down to JLT. Give them a go if you haven't given them a go already, or get them to deliver. Someone got them delivered today. Was that you, Rich? Because there was a Maize bag outside when
yesterday,
I got here this morning.
Yeah.
Was that
No, I tried. They're not open till 12:30. Utterly useless for me.
So we did. We all did dip in at 5:30 this morning.
We're launching breakfast soon. So in breakfast, we'll be sending you guys some food.
Good on you. Lovely to have you in the studio this morning. Luma McClure, the co-founder of Maize Tacos. Thank you so much indeed for being
with us. Thank you so much for having me.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The movers and shakers shaping your world.
Where our newsmaker this morning is a cartoon mouse with big black ears.
M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E.
It's the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse.
Does that take you back to when your kids were a bit younger?
It takes me back to when I was a bit younger as well.
That's a long time ago. Bob Iger has resigned as CEO of the House of Mouse, Disney. Massive story overnight. No one saw this one coming. He's been there since 2006 and done an extraordinary job. When he took over, Disney's share price was about $30 or so. And now it's well over $100. He's done landmark transactions. Hard to believe that before Bob Iger took over, Disney didn't own Pixar. He bought the Steve Jobs animation studio. Disney didn't own Marvel and the Avengers. He did that deal for $4 billion. Disney didn't own Star Wars. He did that deal for about $4 billion. And we talk often about old mergers, acquisitions. They often don't work, lack of cultural fit. Those three have been the textbook, the Harvard Business School case study of how to make a merger work. Seemed a lot of money at the time, $4 billion, particularly for Marvel. Who'd heard of Thor 10 years ago? Who'd heard, really, of Iron Man? But it is now, by some distance, the biggest movie franchise in history, about $20 billion. The second biggest movie franchise in history, Star Wars, $9, $10 billion. Both of them, Bob Iger acquisitions. So why, 18 months ahead of schedule, has he suddenly stepped down? Well, there's no scandal about it. Nor, when I saw this headline, I thought, Bob Iger steps down. I thought, oh dear, what's he done? There's a whiff of scandal here. It's not. He says he's just realized that he wants to do something a little bit different. He is staying with Disney.
So as we looked at the businesses, we felt we have a great set of assets. We have a great strategy. What's next, and what was next in terms of my own priorities, is making sure that the creative pipeline of the company was really rich, that all of our creative engines were working extremely well, and I wanted to spend more and more of my time on that. But the only way that I was able to do that was to give up the day-to-day running of the company to pass the torch on to Bob.
So he's going to be executive chairman. He's going to be in charge of creative. The new guy is another Bob Chapek, who currently runs the theme parks at Disney, but he's going to take over the whole shebang.
I mean, Bob's legacy in the company is just profound. I think my role is now to take the strategic pillars that he's so well established over the last 15 years and continue to work on those and implement those in the marketplace, most importantly our direct-to-consumer initiatives, but at the same time look around the corner for what disruption might be going on in the marketplace that would necessitate a fresh look at those things.
A changing of the guard. Quick question, Tom.
Go on.
Top three Disney movies of all time. Do you want me to have a stab while you think?
Yeah, I mean, I can't even... I think part of the problem of answering that question is exactly what you've just been referencing there, is that there are so many movies now that can be laid at the door of the House of Mouse that maybe before you wouldn't thought of. You know, before you would have just thought, oh, Disney movies, yeah, it's that sort of...
Cinderella.
Family, yeah. The ones that with all the sort of recognisable characters. Whereas now, as you say, you can pretty much throw anything... action into the mix, or certainly superhero into the mix. So top three of all time. Go on, who would you have up there?
I am going to go for, well, the modern one would be Episode 7 of Star Wars, Force Awakens.
Yeah, I've never been a fan, but...
Fair enough. I thought that was a really, really good movie. The two most recent ones, not so much, but that was a really, really good movie. Back in history, 1970s, one of our dinosaurs is missing. Peter Ustinov. Which is a live-action Disney movie.
Yeah.
Just a retro one from my youth. Don't know what else I'd go for. What are you thinking?
You've got to... it depends what... If it's just a personal choice thing, then, you know, you've got to, things like The Jungle Book, et cetera, have got to be thrown in there for me, probably the originals, et cetera. But if it, in terms of impact that Disney films have had, you've got to consider things like Frozen, whether it's your cup of tea or not. But that's the thing. I keep going back to... cartoons. I keep going back to animation.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, and if you look at the one, the kind of the through Disney history, the landmark Aladdin, the one with Robin Williams, kind of saved Disney in the early 90s when it was really, really struggling. Then you look at Toy Story after they bought Pixar.
Yeah,
we take for granted now these computer animated movies, but in the mid 1990s when Toy Story came out, it changed cinema forever. So you'd look at those as
Lion King
as icons. Ooh, never been a fan. Oh, live.
But in terms of impact,
utter dross.
In terms of impact that it had for the company and for them, and they're still churning money off the back of it.
Yeah, I'll give you that. You have a theory about Bob Iger's resignation, don't
he's
you?
He's going to Saudi Arabia. It's far too coincidental, these moves, that on the same day that he says, right, enough's enough, I'm stepping aside. I ain't going... You know, he said that he's going to have consultancy role, he's going to help the other Bob, the House of Bob, as it should be known now. it just seems strange that, you know, moments after he makes that announcement to various news outlets over in the United States, we get this huge entertainment announcement over in Saudi Arabia. So, you know, I'm not one to come up with theories or anything like that, but just watch that space.
Well, there's a lot going on in Saudi Arabia. This is your newsmaker today, His Royal Highness Prince Abdulaziz bin Turki Al Faisal. This is him at Le Mans, because as well as being the new sports minister, he's also an acclaimed racing driver. That was his previous career. This is him speaking at Le Mans, actually talking about the World Endurance Cup visiting Bahrain.
Well, we're very lucky to have five tracks in a very small area, and five of the best tracks around the world. Unfortunately, we don't have manufacturers, so racing and motorsport is really new to the region. Definitely for the WEC Championship coming to Bahrain, or maybe in the future to more racetracks over there, will definitely encourage and have a bigger audience from the region.
Prince Abdulaziz bin Turki Al Faisal, new sports minister in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, formerly head of the General Sports Authority, now the new sports minister, born in 1983, an athlete in his own right, talented entrepreneur as well, spent most of his childhood over in Europe where he pursued an active lifestyle and also got sort of imbibed in motorsports at a very early age. He attained his bachelor's degree from the King Saud University in 2003, then went on to get a degree in politics at the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS.
I got an economics degree from there.
What year?
School of 2001.
Oh, okay, so he's about 4 years after you.
Fair enough. That's why he went. Richard Dean's got a degree from there.
I've heard that Richard Dean on radio over in Dubai. I like what he's doing. I'm off to SOAS as well.
Quite right, too.
He also went back...
Did I tell you who told me to go to SOAS?
Go on.
Brian Scudder.
Oh, did he really?
He did. Blast from the past.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
The Dubai Food Festival 2020 kicks off in style today. It will continue the annual festival of food here all the way through to the middle of March, encouraging more and more people to get out, try something new and take advantage of some great deals. It goes on for a couple of weeks, but what is the market like at the moment and how has it been over the course of the last 12 months? That's why we're inviting into the studio influencers when it comes to the world of food and beverage industry. Heavyweights who've been able to leave their mark on the industry and continue to do so. Now, more so than our next guest, the co-founder of BB Social Dining, one of the most sought-after seats down at DIFC at the moment. Spiro Panagakis joins us live in the studio. Morning.
Good morning, Tom.
I'm looking forward to this chat because I couldn't think of a better guest, a better industry voice piece to give us his thought on F&B here in the region at the moment. Food festival, yeah, a good time, a good cause for celebration. Nothing wrong with people going out, trying something new and getting excited about food. That's what we do on a daily basis. But in terms of an operator, and specifically out of DIFC, which is often held up as one of the sort of success areas for food and beverage, where are we at the moment? I asked our previous guest about saturation and oversaturation. Are we oversaturated?
I think, to be really frank about it, saturation is an infrastructure problem, I think, that we see today in Dubai versus the population there to be able to sustain what we have built today. The DIFC, for example, has now expanded twofold with new developments that were created down by the what we call the avenues. Mm. And when we try to, let's call it lease or rent out another 60 to 90 spaces against the current population that we already have, and we're not growing as a population in the DIFC, saturation occurs. It's very simple. We opened back now 2 years, just over 2 years, BB Social Dining. And in the space of opening up, year one, we had two brand new openings of the same caliber or even more. The following year, we had another seven. So when you're still sitting in the same pie, or let's call it fairly taking a chunk out of the pie, it's A, the competition becomes either too fierce and we end up cannibalizing each other. Or the fact that the population cannot sustain the amount of seats that we've expanded to in, let's call it, pockets of communities to be able to support it.
You mentioned the word rent there, and that's a recurring theme for a number of food and beverage operators here, not just down at DIFC, but across the board as well. Is there a discussion ongoing about rent? Are they becoming more realistic? Because we're not seeing a lack of any new big name openings around the city. They still seem to continue.
Rent is becoming more of a topic than I think it's actually 2020's trend. Okay. as a topic versus things such as veganism or healthy dieting requirements. I think there's a reality sort of sinking in over the last couple of years where landlords are appreciating the difficulty that is being incurred into the business's cash flow. I think adjustments, though, still need to be made because the rental market is too aggressive to what we have as a population to support. Our tourism figures, whilst they're showing positive, recent situations such as the coronavirus has created a massive problem in terms of expectation into the region. And tourism figures are obviously going to be affected going forward. So for a fact, talking about rent, rent needs to be discussed on a daily basis with your landlords because they welcome the discussions and they look to adjust and support where they can. The other reality is, look at your own business and see whether or not that is a successful model and how you should adapt it to look at the current situation, whether it's not a crisis situation, but a demand situation in the market, economies of scale. People's incomes aren't the same as they used to be. We used to have family support when flying people in internationally, when we used to recruit. Today we don't. You know, today we don't support them with schooling, as let's call it as a primary. So therefore, look at your own business model too, because the bums on seats theory has changed.
So some restaurants are still incredibly successful. I mean, you used to be the general manager of Zuma, which is almost big enough to have its own GDP down in DIFC. But there are other really successful restaurants. I mean, one that I always notice when I'm in Design District, Home Bakery, which is a chain of, you know, cafes, but that's always absolutely rammed. And we could mention others as well. So there are pockets within the restaurant industry where you just catch a wave and they're really, really popular. If you've got a butcher who's throwing salt on his steaks, you know, it fills a restaurant every night. What's the winning formula, even in a sluggish market, Spiro?
You know what? It's actually, I don't think it's too difficult to define how it should work, but it's a general matrix of the landlord creates a space. He has a breakdown of its retail and its F&B to a population that could be housed, whether it's from offices or residential. The product itself, are you true to your product? What is your product? And is there a need for the product in the region? We look at Dubai in its developing, growing stages. It does take similar sort of models to places like New York and London, where it's a trend-focused market. We have a bit of a problem here in Dubai is that we focus too much on trend and we multiply them, which just creates a saturation perspective or saturation situation where we can't facilitate because we don't actually have enough demographic in the region or the areas or the pockets to be able to keep those businesses surviving.
20 seconds. So what do you do? That's the reality. It's challenging. As a restaurateur, what do you do?
Stick to your guns because 9 times out of 10, the business success story, you mentioned Zuma before, the owner-operator model in this region proves successful. I look at ourselves and what we do, it's a daily fight, you know, but we stand by the brand, we are the brand, and, you know, we want to face it to the local community because that's what we set out to do. Local homegrown concepts today, I don't say it's the way forward, but there's not enough of them because that means there's not enough belief in the region to say I will stay in Dubai and work in Dubai and live in Dubai. I will grow my family in Dubai. So I think tomorrow an increase in homegrown concepts is where we need to be.
Spiro, it's always good catching up with you. Thanks so much indeed for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. All the best
you,
for 2020 for you and all the team at BB Social Dining. Give them a go down in DIFC. Our thanks to Spiro for joining us live on the show.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.